Hello, and welcome back to Great History Stories. I hope you and your family are staying safe during these continually turbulent times. In exciting news, we are looking at building a website. The Great History Saga continues. I'll keep you updated as things move along, but enough about that. For now, I invite you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Underdogs, episode 24, Qualified. Kids say the darndest things, often to the humiliation of the parents and to the amusement of others. Especially when kids reach about 3 years old, they'll start to share their thoughts on pretty much anything constantly. So you never know what one's gonna blurt out. Like, why is that woman so fat? Or why can't that man walk? As you're walking through the supermarket. This happens because at this age, kids like to flex their look what I noticed muscles. The whole world is new to them, and they finally have the tools to express their curiosity. So when they do, without knowing that they might have said something inappropriate or offensive to others, they don't recognize it. To them, they're not trying to hurt anyone. They're just being curious about something that's new to them. These comments may be pretty amusing to outsiders at a certain age, but the entertainment value fades quickly over time. And what was funny when they were three is just the sign of bad kids, bad parenting, or probably a mixture of both when they're 10. At some point, the child must learn what is and is not appropriate to say. And then, of course, come the teenage years. And who knows what's going to come out of their mouths then. Being disrespectful is pretty much part of being a teenager. You were rude as a teen. I was rude as a teen. Your parents were rude as a teen. One of my old man's go-to stories revolves around him talking back to his mother and then having his father break a ping-pong paddle on his backside in response. We've all been terrible teens at one point or another and have talked back to people that we should not be talking back to. It's part of growing up and developing your independence. Typically, this phase does pass, but often requires some corralling on behalf of the parents. Oftentimes, we have a baseline of what to say when it comes to correcting the bad behavior. But sometimes, kids will say something so outlandish that it's really hard to articulate a response beyond, no, and because I said so. For example, say your 17-year-old daughter comes to you and says, Mom, Dad, I think I want to go to school to learn to be a whore. And then I want to make a career out of being a prostitute. Can you help me pay for college? Like, what do you even say to that? There's no play in the parenting handbook that has prepared you for this conversation. How on earth are you supposed to handle this? Well, that's the situation that William Edward Nightingale has arrived in when his daughter came up to him and told him that she wants to be a nurse. At this time, nursing had about the same reputation as being a lady of the night. Once upon a time in the Middle Ages, they actually had a decent reputation, with churches and monasteries serving as the primary healthcare facilities for the sick. Nurses were often nuns or monks who could attend to patients and even travel to different towns should they require health services. But that changed with the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s. With ancient churches and monasteries shutting their doors, the hospitals within them needed to shut down as well. This meant that nursing, as a profession, was anything but stable. There were only a few places in all of Europe to be trained as a nurse now that all the established hospitals had vanished, and those that did practice rarely did so under settled conditions. They often had to travel from one infected town to another, living a life on the road as they struggled to find adequate equipment to care for the sick and the dying. The hospitals that did exist were disgusting, places of degradation and filth. Hospitals were where the lowest of the low would work. The quote-unquote hospital stench was nauseating to most, and nurses often drank heavily on the job to numb their senses to their surroundings. And often, in their drunkenness, they would court their more attractive patients, earning a bit of a reputation. In the mind of the public, nursing was a filthy profession for filthy people that wanted to live in miserable conditions. It was hardly a career path that any self-respecting woman could take, and was only slightly higher on the social ladder than prostitution was. In an era where there were already so few career opportunities for women, most of them still scoffed at the idea of being a nurse. That was a job for broke, desperate, indebted widows. And yet here, the 17-year-old Florence was telling her father that she wanted to go to school to be a nurse. In his mind, how had things gone so wrong? He had done everything right. He was a very progressive father. In a time when being a woman truly made you a second-class citizen, he had fiercely fought for his daughters to receive a quality education. He had personally tutored them in history, math, classical literature, and philosophy. And it quickly became obvious that Florence was something special. She had a spark of genius that only comes about once in a great while. She became fluent in German, French, and Italian, and could hold a basic conversation in Greek or Latin. Mathematics especially was her forte. She was a wonderful girl with a wonderful mind, and he knew that she could be anything she wanted to be. She could change the world despite being at a severe disadvantage of being a woman in the mid-1800s. To help her grow, he had taken her on a tour of Europe and introduced her to Mary Mole, a fiercely independent and confident woman who could hold her own against any man, who sneered at the thought of being some demure upper-class housewife. Mary and the Nightingales became close friends, and William knew that her influence on his two daughters would make them stronger people, would make them reconsider their place in the world as just another woman. He had such high hopes for Florence, and now she wants to be a nurse? Why? Why, after all these years of educating her and helping her grow into a formidable force of a young woman, was she choosing to throw it all away? Well, according to Florence, because God told her to. When she was only 17 years old, she said she received an order from God calling her to future quote-unquote service. The call at first terrified her. Service? Service? She was a strong, independent woman at a time when it was very difficult to be a free woman, and God had the audacity to call her to service? The young Florence milled the idea over in her mind as she continued in her studies. In her free time, she would bring food and medicine to the local poor, and found that she actually enjoyed serving people in this way. Maybe this is what God had meant when he had called her to service? All the while, Florence was dealing with suitors from London. She was a brilliant 17-year-old woman, after all, and at this time, that meant that she should be getting married off to some other socialite and raise a family of her own. At least, that was society's expectation of her. And if God had meant service to your husband by his cryptic message to her, she wanted little part in that cruel fate. Mary's influence on her had been remarkable, and the thought of just being another rich girl tending to a family bored her to tears. Frustrated and unsure of what God wanted for her and what she wanted for herself, she decided to test the waters. She took her concerns to a visiting American family. Dr. Samuel Howe, a staunch abolitionist in America, and a man who relentlessly helped the blind throughout his entire life, and his wife, Julia Howe, who would later go on to write the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and who was a fierce advocate for woman suffrage, were both visiting the Nightingale home, and Florence figured it was of little consequence if the Howe family learned of her aspirations. When she was alone with them, she asked, quote, "Do you think it is unsuitable and unbecoming for a young Englishwoman to devote herself to the work of charity in hospitals and elsewhere as Catholic sisters do? Do you think it would be a dreadful thing?" End quote. Dr. Howe pondered the question. Of course, the traditional English answer would be that it would be unusual indeed, and rather unsuitable for a woman of Florence's standards. However, the Howls were anything but traditional. After proceeding with the cautionary warnings about what the reaction might be, they encouraged Florence to go for it, to act on her inspiration, and to be the person that God was calling her to be. Emboldened by her conversation with the Howls, Florence went to her father and asked if she could be trained as a nurse at an infirmary run by a family friend, and was immediately shot down. Even with how progressive her family was, there was no way they were going to let her throw her life away and become a filthy nurse. Florence basically replied, "Fine, I'll do it myself." She thought through her list of allies and eventually wrote to Sidney Herbert to ask for help. Sidney was pretty much the male version of Florence. He was born rich, but was handsome. Brilliant, even. He studied at Oxford, entered Parliament at the age of 21. He became a leading expert in the House on army matters, and became obsessed with keeping his country safe. Part of that obsession was the issue of sanitation. If fewer soldiers lost their lives to disease, then fewer recruits would be needed to defend the country, and the forces on the front would be stronger for it. Sidney received Florence's cry for help and figured that he was in a position to aid a like-minded friend. So he sent her back countless invaluable government reports on national health conditions. Florence took to them like a duck to water, getting up before dawn every day to pore over them under the light of an oil lamp, filling notebook after notebook with facts and figures, combining the science of nursing with her knowledge of mathematics to better understand the field she was so desperate to join. Eventually, she wore her family down. After years of watching their daughter comb through these government reports and years of her begging to let her go studying, they gave up on trying to stop her outright and figured a few years spent in a hospital would be more than enough to get her to change professions. Nobody lasted as a nurse by choice, after all. This began a parade across Europe of Florence visiting nursing schools. She attended a school in Germany and attempted to learn at a school in Paris before she, ironically, came down with measles and had to go home. However, after proving herself as a capable nurse, the Institution for Care of Sick Gentlewomen and Distressed Circumstances, which just might be the most British name to ever exist, hired her on as a superintendent. They were impressed by her study of health and hospital problems, and when cholera broke out in the hospital, and most of the nurses refused to work out of fear of catching the disease, Florence acted as a nurse herself, and earned universal respect from this hospital staff and from the public, who hailed Miss Nightingale as a hero. It was just in time, too, because when the Crimean War erupted, England was in desperate need of her heroes. Reports were coming back from the war correspondents that condition in English field hospitals were horrifying, and the public demanded that something be done. Sidney Herbert, now the Secretary of War, knew that he needed a man on the ground to improve the situation. Actually, no. He did not need a man on the ground. He needed the most qualified person he knew to go to Crimea and fix as much as they could with the current field hospital system. There was only one person he wanted for the job, Florence Nightingale. He wrote her and created the new position of superintendent of the female nursing establishment in the English General Hospitals in Turkey, and asked if she would be willing to go in service of God and kingdom. Service, you say? That was just the sign that Florence had been looking for after years of waiting. Her prayers answered, she accepted the job, and the public took some small comfort in knowing that, though their boroughs were suffering in filth for now, Florence Nightingale is on the case. And that was a small, but not insignificant comfort. On next week's episode, now what? Good luck, Florence. You're going to need it. Until next time, this has been Great History Stories. I'm Mark Cyrus.